I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today, we are talking about Pride and Prejudice, the 2005 film directed by Joe Wright, screenplay by Deborah Magach, based on the novel by Jane Austen. I'm joined by the Lessons from the Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, Mr. Tucker.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
We're talking about Pride and Prejudice because I had not seen this film, and when I said that aloud, everyone else on the team said, what are you doing not having seen this film? And so we decided to do a podcast about it because that's probably the best way to force me to watch a thing.
Yes.
And it worked. So I've now seen Pride and Prejudice. And it was definitely, I remember seeing it on posters a lot. Like it was a film that I felt like it was kind of remarkable that I hadn't seen because I saw a lot of movies at that time. So yeah, so it was interesting going and seeing that. I think it's also my first Jane Austen exposure of any kind.
Wow. Really?
Which we can talk about. Yeah, because I don't think I was ever like in school. I don't think we ever had to read any of her books. And generally speaking, I don't read a book unless I'm forced to. So, but yeah, we can talk about all that.
Wow.
But learning more about it and her has been really interesting. So yeah, so mission accomplished. I've seen it. I'm curious for you guys, when did you guys see it and what was your experience around it? Brian, what about you? When did you see it?
I saw it when it came out. I don't remember the circumstances. I know I saw it by myself. I think it was one of the first years I was paying attention to all the Oscar movies because like looking up the Oscars that year, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember seeing all those movies around the same time. And yeah, I loved it. And always the scene that I remember the most is Donald Sutherland saying, you know, your mother will never speak to you if you don't marry him and I'll never speak to you if you will. And I just remember that moment being like, oh, good. She has an ally. And Donald Sutherland is adorable and amazing. And so I remember the movie very fondly, but have not watched it in 15 years. So it was great to revisit it.
Nice.
Yeah, I saw it when it came out in theaters and I really enjoyed it. I remember not really knowing much about the actual story or I don't think I had read a Jane Austen book. And I was really surprised by the filmmaking. You know, I went in not really expecting anything special. And you know, this is Joe Wright's first film
which
he directed.
Which is crazy. Yeah.
It's first film. That's
so
crazy.
Gorgeous. Yeah.
Right. And I remember just one of the first shots of the movie is like floating through the house. I was like, wait a minute, is this a long take? What's happening? This is not a movie with long takes, is it? And realizing throughout the film of like what interesting filmmaking was happening. So I liked it more than I expected. And I also loved the soundtrack. It became kind of
so
like my default like homework music. Like I think it was my first year of college, I think. So it was like definitely like on repeat soundtrack constantly. So I feel like I know the soundtrack better than the film. Ultimately. It's just like I've listened to it more than I've seen the movie.
Quick question, because this happens to me with video games. Like if you know the soundtrack better than the movie, do you then watch the movie and sort of like have nostalgia for like the soundtrack in a weird way? Like do you hear certain score moments and be like, oh, I love this like I have more of a connection with this moment than I do with this scene in the movie necessarily.
Absolutely. Yeah. I had that experience watching it again. I'm like, oh yeah, this track.
Interesting. Yeah. What about you, Trisha?
So I saw this when it came out and at the time I wasn't like a big fan of drawing room dramas or like the Regency like romantic drama kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But that's absolutely not true, actually, because in the 90s, they were making a bunch of these. Like they made the Gwyneth Paltrow version of Emma, and the BBC version of Pride and Prejudice was a really big deal. And then they made the Sense and Sensibility adaptation with Emma Thompson, which is, you know, excellent. And so they were making these and I did watch all of those at the time, but I wouldn't have said that was my favorite genre of film or anything like that. I took a class on the British Romantics in college and I, full disclosure, did not love it at all. Like I didn't love that class or the British Romantics. but this was right around the time that I would have been taking that class. And it just really impressed me for the filmmaking, which you're talking about, Alex, but also it is a totally different approach to this kind of, it's actually, you know, sort of what's known in British cinema as like a heritage film, which is kind of a loaded term anyway. And
sounds kind of racist.
And that's the criticism of this kind of movie, right?
Right.
Because this style of film is always about upper class, like sort of worries and issues, and everybody's white, and like there's no poor people anywhere. you know, but. And that is a critique. The other side of the coin, of course, is that these stories are almost always about women who are kind of bucking trends and expectations in the time that they're in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's sort of, there's like a deep dive that we could do down into like British film criticism and theory on heritage movies, but we'll try to keep this. But this is just approach stylistically in a very different way than a lot of those others. So like if you stand this next to something like the 1995 or 1996 Emma or Sense and Sensibility, it just looks completely different.
Right.
It actually is. It feels like modern filmmaking.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's definitely the first thing I was struck by also, is just how exactly that the modern filmmaking feel, and also had that reaction that you were describing, Alex, of like, is this a long take? Yeah, this is a long take. This is kind of fun as it's like going through the party and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that was the first top level thing that I was impressed by, is that there are scenes that again could be like fine on their own if shot in a traditional way.
Right.
But the commitment to doing it just a little differently really amplified the sensation of it. And I feel like the one I liked the most was when Keira Knightley's dancing with Mr. Darcy, and it's all like the one long shot, and it's kind of zoomed and it's following them and going like, but it follows one over this way and then back that way, and you kind of feel like you're dancing with them. I feel like that was all just really, it added that extra layer, which is fun to have in a scene like that.
And in that same scene, the Mr. Collins trying to like have a conversation with her, but like, constantly being cut off because of the dance moves. It's so brilliantly executed.
I
think it's interesting because there was definitely a decade for around the aughts where there was a little bit of the style of let's make a period piece, but in a cool modern way. And like The Prestige, I think, did it really well.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you have something like Plunkett and McLean, which not everyone has seen. it's by Jake Scott, one of the Scott's sons. Mm-hmm. And it's half of the cast of Trainspotting. It's Robert Carlyle and Johnny Lee Miller, and they're like highwaymen in the rest restoration period, and Liv Tyler's there, and Alan Cumming is amazing and
interesting,
but it sort of takes this like almost like a Quentin Tarantino Django Unchained approach of, we're not even going to try to pretend that we're not going to get you to pretend that you are in this time period. We're going to do sort of total stylistic modern filmmaking,
right?
And for better or for worse, obviously. And I think that 95% of Pride and Prejudice works for me, and I think the only thing that has not aged well is the sort of handheld zoom like shots and that kind of thing, where it sort of feels like you have this very like the natural lighting, the cinematography is so beautiful, and the production design, and I think those long takes really help feel you immersed in the world. But then suddenly it feels like I'm watching The Office, where like someone says something and then like the camera quickly zooms on someone to get their reaction and things like that. So those are the little things where I'm like, yeah, that wouldn't, like, Joe Wright would not be doing that in 2020, like,
right?
But it was kind of a little more of the style of the time. And it's one of those things that just stood out to me as, okay, this is maybe where the filmmaking and there's sort of a dissonance between the filmmaking and the subject matter and the world. But again, that's 5% of the otherwise, in my mind, 95% like fantastic filmmaking.
Yeah. It's really interesting that around this time, and maybe this is what you're talking about, Bri, because it wasn't just happening in period films, but it seemed like directors were able and very, in fact, invested in entering the conversation about why we make movies the way that we do.
Sure.
And so actually the movie that I'm thinking about right now that we've talked about with this before is Casino Royale, where it's just a complete, which was right around this, like this exact time, basically, you know, in the early aughts, there's this, you know, great shift toward realism and, you know, sort of overall like a darker or messier look at all kinds of genres. And we see that in action with something like Casino Royale, where you're sort of stripping away the veneer of like all the James Bond, like shiny, slick, gadgety kind of things. But we also see this in our period films, and even like, well, they definitely stopped making rom-coms, but of course, like in sci-fi, we've talked about before on the show, they were doing that as well. So it's something like War of the Worlds, which we talked about with Lindsay Ellis. So I think it was really a conscious choice for a lot of these directors to wade into this. Why do we shoot movies the way that we do? And is that always serving the story and serving the audience the best way that it could be?
Right.
Yeah. I'm having memories of walking into the theater that I would always go to see movies at when I was, you know, in middle school. Mm-hmm. And with my group of friends, a lot of which were girls. And so we were kind of seeing movies that I probably wouldn't have seen on my own, because it was like, there's no explosions. I only care about that. I'm 14. But like, yeah, I was just looking at like A Knight's Tale is something that's like totally like remixing things. And even like Romeo plus Juliet by Baz Luhrmann and Moulin Rouge. Yeah. Like there was this kind of weird mini era where it's like, let's just remix all the things.
Right.
And that's kind of fun. And it's interesting. I wonder if that kind of then bled over to the more prestige, you know, filmmakers and kind of influenced the trajectory of filmmaking in that way. Because I feel like there was also this like the shift of like the indie film style, I feel like started to bleed over, especially with like Christopher Nolan being chosen to do Batman Begins coming from Memento and like
Jon Favreau doing Iron Man. Yeah.
Yeah. Right,
yeah. So yeah, there is this kind of interesting shift happening in this period that I hadn't really clocked before.
Yeah. And if you're not well acquainted with this kind of movie, or especially like the 90s incarnations of it, it might not be easy to see the ways that it comes out in Pride and Prejudice, but it's definitely there. There actually is, just in terms of like what feels modern about it, it's actually there very much in just the way that this entire thing was approached. So, for example, the adaptations of this novel are typically set in the classic like High Regency era, which has a totally different look than, so like this book was published in 1813, which was like sort of the classic English Regency kind of thing, where you would see like the empire waist dresses, you know, and very just opulence kind of.
I liked that Regency is also defined by the period where King George was going crazy. Is the thing that I learned today? Anyway, that's just, yep. There was unsettlement because the king was going crazy. Anyway,
correct.
Continue.
Joe Wright and Deborah Mongach did very uniquely. They approached this as like an earlier, like sort of less clean and polished time. And they actually downgraded the Bennetts in terms of like how much money that they had. Mm. I mean, they definitely would not have had money, and that is sort of like the crux of the plot to begin with, which is that the Bennetts are disadvantaged, but they're still among society. They're still landowners, that kind of thing. But just, yeah, all the mud, like thinking about all those barnyard scenes and like, you know, the daughter's out walking in the rain and like, can she borrow the carriage? No, she can't. She's just going to walk over there. Like that's all. It has a much more grounded feeling to it.
That's part of my experience when I first watched it as well, was I was expecting the 90s, like polished, everything's really clean and prim and proper version of this kind of story. And it was really gratifying actually to have like a dirty world, you know, where like things get muddy, people don't always look perfect. Like their clothes are a little bit rumpled. Like it feels like a lived in universe and not this Hollywood, like, clean, pristine version of, you know, high society,
which I think is reflected in the filmmaking.
Yeah, I agree. I think I like that it plays with the expectations you have of this world, where everybody is talking in this very mama papa, you know, kind of way that you would expect. And I'm sure a lot of the dialogue is taken straight from the book, and that's why it is, you know, like they didn't want to just completely change that dialogue. But then you have these little moments of, like you were saying, Collins trying to dance and have a conversation at the same time. And it's almost like the character and the filmmakers saying, we know this is a little silly, let's have fun with the fact that it's a little silly. Or the butler or valet coming in and having to announce Mrs. Bennett, Miss Bennett, Miss Bennett, Miss Bennett, and Miss Bennett. Yeah. And I think that there are those little moments of saying, this is the time period and we are being serious with it, but at the same time, we are going to have a little fun with it, especially since the entire theme of the movie is our protagonist shirking those mores of the time, you know.
Yeah, there's a thing in the examples of earlier examples of the genre that I mentioned already where no one talks over each other. Everyone just sort of like stands stiffly and waits for somebody to finish speaking. And then the next mm-hmm. person goes ahead and speaks. And the scene you're talking about with Collins at the ball where like he's talking, we're hearing different conversations at once. We're like hearing the music loud in the mix. We're hearing people's footsteps like stomping up and down. And thinking about the scenes, especially the scenes in the Bennett's house, where the girls are running around, like giggling, and like Mary's banging on the piano. Uh-huh. It's a deconstruction of a lot of that, the stiffness that I think people at this point really just weren't interested in right. a period film.
It's a really funny movie too. Like,
yeah,
you know,
really funny. Tom Hollander.
Yeah, Collins is amazing.
Yeah, like all of his scenes, I'm just so happy right. when he's on screen. Yeah.
The worst right. haircut they ever could have put on him or anybody. God well, bless.
He just commits to that role so hard.
He's like, amazing.
He just, I think he steals every scene he's in because
oh, yeah.
he's
yeah.
so embodying this that guy, you know?
Like, the scene where he walks up behind Darcy and Darcy is like not paying attention to him. And it looks like, I don't know, it seems like Matthew McFadden is like 2 feet taller than Tom.
Well, I think you can also tell when Collins is trying to dance that they just specifically cast like 6'2" tall men to be around him. So he's just completely yeah. dwarfed by them.
It's also weird watching this, having just talked about pirates. Mm-hmm. It was weird to be like, Admiral Beckett, what are you doing here? And get away from Elizabeth Swann. Anyway.
Totally. Well, if we could talk about Keira Knightley playing a woman named Elizabeth who doesn't really like the world that she's in and is supposed right. to marry this guy who she's not that interested in and is trying to like shirk the culture and everything. I'm like, yeah, it's pretty much, she's kind of typecast. There's this show called How Not to Live Your Life. It's a British sitcom from about a decade ago. The main character, he talks through voiceover, so he's talking to the audience, and he ends up, I think, dating a woman who's very well to do, and he goes to her parents' estate, and it's this like huge like Downton Abbey type thing, and he says, oh, her parents' estate was amazing. It was like something out of a Keira Knightley novel.
That's great.
That's pretty great. Well, and even Mr. Wickham, when he showed up, I was like, Orlando Bloom?
No, clearly
not
is.
Orlando Bloom. Yeah, but like, yeah. clearly
yeah, it's like
supposed
the
to be Orlando
Bloom stand-in. Like.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But the only other line I was going to say that I mean, there's so many really funny moments in this movie, but one of the lines that made me just laugh out loud was Judi Dench so seriously and so sternly saying, if I had studied piano, I would have been a great proficient. she's like, is so sure that she would be amazing at piano if she had actually bothered to learn.
Right.
And this reminds me, Brian, of something that you said earlier that I was going to comment on, which is that, so a lot of the dialogue in Deborah Moggach's original script was taken straight out of the book. Like when mm-hmm. she first started working on adapting this, because she is a novelist. I mean, she's also a wonderful screenwriter, but primarily what she does is adapt novels in like, especially classic novels into like screenplays. And so she wanted to be really faithful. And for the record, Pride and Prejudice to many readers, I was going to say British readers, but also many American readers is like sacred. It's something that as the novel itself is like widely studied. It's widely read even today. And so it's a property that comes loaded with like expectation if you're going to approach it as an adaptation. And so Joe Wright, even before he came on board, Deborah Moggach was really trying to stay faithful to it. And then as they got into this idea of, well, let's actually blend it with a little bit more modernism, a little bit more realism. Let's change the time period that it's typically set in. You know, so I think they said that this adaptation is technically set in like 1790, somewhere around there, as opposed to 1813, which is when it's normally, like the 18 teens, when it's normally set. Hmm. There is actually a decent amount of like modern sentence construction in the dialogue, even if it still feels like a little difficult to our ears.
Right.
Believe me when I tell you, it is easier than like reading the dialogue straight out of the novel. And I think what that does is actually bring out the humor, because the novel is really funny, but it's like difficult to access the humor when you're just sort of like fighting upstream through the language. Right, and so actually taking a little bit of a more modern approach to the language brings out the intent and the wit that Jane Austen already had written into the novel.
It actually reminds me of a movie that I think Brian didn't like very much, but I loved from last year, The King on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And one thing I really liked about that film was that they were adapting kind of Shakespearean language mm-hmm. with a modern twist. So it was kind of giving me the best of both worlds, where I kind of got a really modern feeling film, but it carried with it a lot of the weight and the poetry of the more kind of Shakespearean dialogue. So I really like when that can be accomplished. And Pride and Prejudice does it for me as well, where it's like, I'm getting the humor, I'm with the characters, I understand the story, but there's also a poetry to it. And the wit is almost, you know, enhanced because it's being delivered in such an exquisite way.
Yes.
So I'd like to see more films like this where they do that hybrid kind of mashup of the language. I really like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's always an interesting choice how true a filmmaker will stay to, well, what exactly did they sound like during that time,
right,
or how do we want to present it? You know, something like Little Women, which the recent one, which was made in a very modern way, but also it's an American novel from 50 years later than Pride and Prejudice. So it's a little easier to sort of take on, or a movie where the Russians speak in British accents because it's just easier to do it that way. We don't make the whole, you know, but then Hunt for Red October is like, we're going to show you that we are making this choice by zooming in and zooming out. But I think like Lord of the Rings is a good example of something that, you know, no one's saying doth or anything like that. It's just like they are speaking in this way that is heightened and feels sort of like it has this old English pitch to it, but at the same time they're not saying words that are completely or like sentence structure or anything that are completely strange to our ears. So we can sort of, like you were saying, Alex, it's kind of this nice hybrid of, we want to be true to the time period or the source material or whatever it is, but we also don't want to alienate you. You know, if you're adapting Shakespeare is written in iambic pentameter, so you are either using it or you're not, and you make that choice. But when you're adapting almost anything else, then you have to sort of find that balance between the two.
Well, and the example of somebody who commits 100% to veracity with no need, like feeling no obligation to translate, is Robert Eggers with The Witch and The Lighthouse, both of which I don't even know most of what was spoken in The Witch. I have to rewatch it like with subtitles on, because the first time I saw it in theaters, I was like, I don't know what is being said here. It sounds really cool because it's like literally like the journal entries from like pilgrims.
Right.
But like the way they're like constructing their sentences and speaking is like almost a foreign language. So that's an interesting choice to make if you want to just be like, we're just going to immerse you 100% almost as an experiment. But you're going to alienate a lot of people that way.
And I do think that, so what we're talking about is you essentially have to kind of invent your own version of a historical language. Mm-hmm. I mean, in something like Lord of the Rings, it truly is fantasy. So you really can just invent the language out of anything, but it's still English, right? So it's like, you still are going to pick an era of English essentially and use it. So I ran into something very similar to this a few years ago. I wrote a play that was set in 325 AD in the Roman Empire. Don't ask why. It's a long thing. But the point is, obviously, I was just I had to invent a language because anything from that time was written in ancient Greek, and the earliest translations of it weren't made for hundreds of years. So I basically had to like pick, and I ended up picking like an 1800s sort of like construction for it. I think that this version of Pride and Prejudice excels, but I do think there are moments at different ends of the spectrum where sometimes it feels really like I can tell it's straight out of the book from 1813. Mm-hmm. And other times when I can tell it was written in 2005 for sure. Mm-hmm. Even though the 2005 lines don't feel that terrible to me, I think to me the polarities are like, the 2005-est scene in it is the one where Elizabeth is talking back to the Dame Judi Dench character, mm-hmm. Lady Catherine de Bourgh, at the dinner table. And she's saying things like,
get out, bro.
Yeah.
YOLO.
I think that's actually a direct quote from that scene. But she's talking about how her sisters are all grown up, and she's like, yes, ma'am, they're all out in society. It doesn't really have the complexity that you get from the Jane Austen dialogue. And then the furthest other end of the spectrum to me is the one where Elizabeth and Caroline Bingley are walking around that room and Darcy is sitting at the desk and just being like, what are your designs? If you wish me to observe your figures, I can see them much better from here. Like that is straight out of the book and it feels that way. If you stood those two scenes in the same, like right next to each other, I think it would feel a bit more jarring. But because the movie is on this kind of spectrum, like always on a sliding place in there, it works. Same thing with like the different way, the degrees of politeness that we see witnessed from the characters too, as I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, I think as like the sort of values in the movie get broken apart a little, so does the dialogue. And I'm not saying it's like they thought this through really hard, but it does seem like the movie starts with a lot of this kind of heightened thing. And then as it goes a little more deep into it, then you get relaxed a little bit more in that. And you start to feel more modern sentences, more kind of a familiar feel.
Definitely.
Yeah, I really like that drawing room scene where they, you take like a, what did she say? Like a walk.
A turnabout the room.
A turnabout the room.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just because I feel like the movie does do that modern thing of drawing out the like kind of absurdity of all this.
Yeah.
And just like the slow, weird pace at which life is lived when you have nothing to do because you're just filthy rich. And
literally
like,
nothing to do.
You're just lounging all the time. And so it's just like, I'm going to refresh myself by walking in a circle now. And you know,
I mean, is that so hard to identify with in 2020? These
days? Right. But like without iPhones, without video games, like there's nothing, you know, that you can read or write or, you know.
I'll be right back, guys. I'm going to go take a turn about the room.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I just think it's a fun scene in a slow, strange way because it's drawing out the strangeness of.
And Keira Knightley, she never really looks straight into camera, of course, but there are moments in this where she almost is like does a gym from The Office. Like, is this really happening now?
Right.
And that's one of the moments where Caroline is like, take a turn about the room with me. And she's like, okay, that's a normal, not absurd thing to do. Sure.
Right. That was one of the first moments where I thought, is this movie just really drilling hard on sort of this is how the world was, or is it sort of playing with a little? And then I think it's immediately followed by Mrs. Bennet, Miss Bennet, Miss Bennet, you know, where you see like the look on his face. He's like, I have to address things this way. Like, this is my life. And I think, okay, cool. Like, we are in sort of playful territory, even though we are not making fun of this world necessarily, but we are playing with the rules.
Kelly Reilly as Caroline also.
Yes.
Like, wonderful. She's wonderful. Just exactly the person that you want to hate. Like, just
right,
deliciously
just,
so.
Just her facial expressions are just, they just do so much.
Right. Yeah, I think that I think surprised by, because of my ignorance about Jane Austen, was this wit that we're talking about, where going into it, you know, I really didn't know exactly what to expect. Like, a romance from British people, times being British-y stuff, right? Like, it's kind of the vague idea I had in my head.
Wow.
And watching it, I realized that I'd seen parts of it before, because again, a lot of my friends, especially in high school, were very into it and had very strong opinions about Colin Firth, Mr. Darcy, versus Matthew McFadden, Mr. Darcy.
Like, oh, right. That was like a big thing, wasn't it? Yeah.
Jane Austen fans are serious, man. I don't mess with them. They have a lot of thoughts.
Really intense debates about the Darcys.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And watching this, I was like, I came around to Matthew McFadden, but I got why people were like, no, Colin Firth. I was like, yeah, I mean, I feel like I want Colin Firth right now. Like, I feel like I always want Colin Firth, though. So
sure. I mean, yeah, we all do.
Colin Firth is so Mr. Darcy. He played Mr. Darcy in Bridget Jones' Diary also, where in the book she mentions like, oh, Mark Darcy, he looks kind of like Colin Firth. And then they made a movie and Colin Firth plays him. He has been our Mr. Darcy for...
He is the darciest Darcy ever. But I really do love Matthew McFadden in this.
Yeah,
it's funny now because he's now like the guy from Succession. So it was fun to watch it after seeing a very different character in Succession. Have you guys seen Succession? Anybody here?
have not.
Yeah,
stop outing us on stuff we haven't seen on the podcast. Listen,
it's usually me or Michael, so it's nice when it's not us. In Succession, he plays a really particular character, so it's it's interesting to see him back before he was known as that character. Anyway,
but yeah, so again, I had this kind of vague expectation where I associated Pride and Prejudice with people in high school arguing about Colin Firth or not, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And so I was expecting a well-made film about a romance story, and even just the framing of that is loaded, obviously. Sure. But I think I was delighted by, I turned on subtitles because I think that's just kind of the default when anything is super British for me, just to make sure my bases are covered. And so I was surprised.
Stay tuned for next week's episode.
Oh God, is that British? God. Oh boy. All right.
I cannot wait.
Turn on all the subtitles. Anyway, yeah. So it was this, along with the delight of seeing the filmmaking being this level above, it was the writing, the delight of the writing isn't so much even what's happening in the plot. It's how it's being conveyed. And kind of in the research that I've done into Jane Austen in the last 24 hours, and I literally watched a crash course video about the story because I wanted to understand the context more. And, they use passages from the book, and it kind of all made it click for me in a way that I don't think I appreciated or was really ever, I'm not going to say I wasn't ever given the opportunity to appreciate, because I could have just watched the movie or read the book. But I feel like it's... It's not something that goes along with how these films are presented. And so it was really cool to learn about that and learn about her writing style and the wit and the sarcasm and the biting phraseology that just feels so modern. The little bits I read, I was oh my God, this person, I want to be this person. So I feel like that was one of the big takeaways for me. It's understanding that there's multiple layers happening here. And that so much of the richness comes from the kind of commentary on society that's buried within those layers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I mean, to have the protagonists of a rom-com, I'm going to call this a rom-com. Okay. Why not?
Sure. Yeah.
Listen, every time it's adapted into the modern day, as Brian was pointing out, it's a rom-com. And most of these books are. I mean, every adaptation of Emma is a rom-com,
Right.
Anyway, so it's certainly a very old trope to have two central characters in a rom-com that really hate each other or just clash over their fundamental values. There's nothing that we love more in that dynamic than when they're on equal verbal sparring levels.
Yeah.
Where they really can dish it back and forth and kind of break through each other's facades. There's that, again, that wit and intelligence to that exchange of ideas. So I love it when Elizabeth is sitting at the piano after Catherine de Bourgh has ordered her to play.
Mm-hmm.
And Fitzwilliam comes over and he's like, oh, what was my friend like? It, when he was in the countryside with you. And she's like, do you really care to know? Prepare yourself for something truly terrible, And Darcy is standing there and he can hear what she's saying. And then they get into this exchange of ideas. She's like, oh, no one can be introduced at a ball. He's like, I didn't know anybody. There's not none of us are that witty in real life where we can just dish it back that quickly, right? We always think of it so much later. Mm-hmm. But it has that heightened reality and that satisfaction when someone dishes it in a movie in the moment. And the longer it goes on, almost the more exciting it gets, and it creates that chemistry. I mean, Matthew McFadden and Keira Knightley have great chemistry anyway, but it's in the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of Sorkin for that reason.
Yeah.
It's like people are smarter than they ever should be,
right.
But it fits in this world and in the story in a way that Sorkin dialogue often doesn't in some of the stories that he writes. It made me really want to read the book because just the few passages I saw, I was like, every half of the sentence has so much happening. And there was a quote that I came across that I think Jane Austen wrote in a letter that I just loved, that is, she said, I do not want people to be very agreeable as it saves me the trouble of liking them a great deal. I feel like that, I just love that. I don't know. So that was a fun discovery for me.
That's interesting. Yeah. One thing that it struck me watching the film again was that for as modern as so much of what we're talking about feels, what's interesting about like some of the second half of the film for me that like didn't feel modern was the fact that kind of everybody, including Elizabeth, is distraught about certain improprieties that seem right. so silly now, but like in that context, in that time, are like absolutely devastating and absolutely like destroying of all mm-hmm. reputation and all everything. And so I think that's where it's almost like you can modernize certain aspects of a story like this, but then there are these like social norms and like, you know, the thing that is the problem, things that needs to be solved, like is hard to resonate with, you know, for me, where it's like, you know, the way that Darcy redeems himself is by like paying off people to like make sure like the wedding is like
by being super rich.
Yeah, basically like paying off a lot of people and basically like saving like reputation.
Yeah.
And for Elizabeth, she's like she is kind of pushing against norms and breaking norms, but ultimately that is the ultimate like beautiful thing you can do in this world is like throw your money around to like save reputations and like make things right in like high society's eyes. So that was where it was kind of funny to me. It was just like in this world, the romance is like achieved via this like not modern, you know, path. You know, it's like it's via reputation and money and agreements and not right. the more modern romance idea of like follow your heart, follow your feelings. It's like he proved himself, his true character through these acts, you know, which are coming from a heartfelt place because they're for her and her family. Mm-hmm. But that was where it was kind of making me like giggle a little bit. Like, this is interesting how like as modern as Elizabeth is, the things she's ultimately concerned about and the things that get resolved don't feel modern at all.
Right.
Yeah. I would argue that her feelings are her feelings, but her misunderstandings about his actions in the first two acts mm-hmm. of the movie are what makes her not want to be with him. And it's not necessarily so much about his actions, like you were saying. I think it's more just about her understanding that his beliefs weren't what she thought and his prior actions were for different reasons than what she thought. That's the prejudice, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think his actions are an extra little icing on the cake of showing how much he cares and how willing he is to do whatever to sort of make things right, at least in her eyes. But I would argue that her genuine feelings come more from, I like this guy and it turns out he's not a dick like I thought he was, right. you know, and his actions help prove that. But I would say it's more her turning point is more understanding that he didn't do the things she hated for the reasons that she thought.
Yeah. I mean, what you're talking about, Alex, is a common difficulty in historical film, which is that if it's not modern or if it's not set in a world that we're familiar with, and I think we talked about this a little bit with The Devil Wears Prada, if it's set in an unfamiliar world, whether that's a time period or a culture or whatever it is, or even just like a very specific workplace, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If it's set in an unfamiliar world, one of the things that you absolutely have to do as quickly and clearly as you can as a screenwriter is define the value systems of that world. And the more removed it is from the world of your audience, the harder that is to do.
Right.
And so I feel like this is a really good example. Obviously, Jane Austen, when she wrote the source material here and wrote the novel, was writing to readers in her own world who definitely would have immediately understood the value systems. So that becomes a huge challenge of the adaptation. We've discussed this many times in terms of adaptation challenges. Novels are not the same, and there's a lot you have to pack in if you're going to adapt it into one feature film, and there's a lot you're going to have to cut. But
right.
one thing you can't cut is the value system building, because otherwise there are no stakes for your characters. So like, we, the audience, need to understand as quickly as we can. It happens to be the first scene of the novel. And it's the first scene of this movie where Mrs. Bennet is talking to Mr. Bennet. You know, Netherfield Hall has been let. There is a very rich bachelor that is staying there. He must marry one of our daughters because he must marry one of our daughters. It's a very, very smart place to open this movie. But then the movie takes great care. The screenplay takes great care to reinforce this value system throughout, where the marriages of, like, she turns down Collins, and that decision wouldn't feel like there were any stakes to it if we didn't clearly understand if she turns down Collins, they could lose their home, right? Because he's the inheritor of their home and their property. This is something that her mom is actively trying to orchestrate to save her daughters from financial ruin and hardship. And Elizabeth turns it down because of the way that she feels. Mrs. Bennet, you know, ends up being sort of the embodiment of the value system throughout.
Right.
But the movie does a great deal of work to keep all of that stuff in. And to me, one of the most poignant scenes where we see this is when Charlotte, Elizabeth's friend, comes to tell her that she's marrying Collins. And that's where we really see it spelled out. It reminds me of that scene you were talking about, Brian, with Florence Pugh, with Amy in the newest adaptation of Little Women.
Exactly what I was thinking. Like a character sort of, like you said, not looking into the camera, but basically saying, this is why we have to make these choices. Because as you were saying, it is hard for us as a modern audience to know, well, why wouldn't they just do this? And it is very helpful when a character says, I wish I could do those things. I can't. That is not the world that I live in. Maybe it's the world you live in. Yep. It's not the world I live in. It's very smart, obviously, to, if there's sort of an unfamiliar world, you have this protagonist who their morals align more with ours as a modern audience, which is sort of them kind of ahead of their time going into the future, as opposed to if you have a bunch of normal characters and one of them goes and joins a cult and that's your protagonist. It's like, all right, you have to sell this cult to me, but this is almost the opposite. It's someone living in this world of rules that feels alien to us, but they are saying, we don't get these rules and they don't make sense to us. And then you have an ally in Donald Sutherland where it's like, oh, finally someone else who agrees, as opposed to someone like Judi Dench's character, who is the other end of you cannot break from tradition and how dare you and things. But I just always appreciate anytime a protagonist of a sort of alien world is, or it doesn't have to be the protagonist, any character who sort of feels like our way in to this strange world and helps us understand that it doesn't really make a lot of sense, but we're going to hang out here for a while and just bear with us.
Speaking of Judi Dench, like my note that I took was, I just wrote in all caps, Dame Judi Dench. when like the camera reveals her like looking as like Dame Judi Dench as possible and just being
the
like,
size of her hair,
like her and all of her Judi Denchness, it was just so beautiful. And I was like, it like reinvigorated me at that point in the movie. I was like, oh my god, I forgot. Like, yes,
I feel like every movie should have surprise Judi Dench, like 40 minutes in. It's like the opposite of surprise Matt Damon. The scene you were just talking about, Brian, where her best friend comes back and it's like, I married Collins, like that's the world. That is really effective for all the reasons you were saying. And I also immediately had a flashback because she's like, you know what, like I'm 27, like this is like really good for me.
Right.
And I flashed back to the Butch Cassidy scene where she's like, I'm 26, I'm single, I'm a school teacher, and that's the bottom of the pit. Yeah. It's like it's exactly the same thing. Like, you're like in your mid to late 20s kind of, and you're not married, and that's the worst thing. And that's hilarious to me now and sad all the
historically
same time.
I do also like that the rules of this world are not, hey, I like you, let's go on a date. It's just, let's all get engaged to each other. Just like we go from like, boy, she's handsome to we're engaged.
Right. Like, oh, like wow, we've barely spoken.
Right.
And like the next step is engagement, which is just like that's the rules of the world, which also feel alien to us.
But, right.
Yeah. It's like, that's how it happened.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was still like the barrier for me for entry, is that like even understanding the rules of the world, it was still hard for me to like empathize and identify, kind of like you were saying also, and especially in the second half, like, you know, things were happening and part of me was just like, well, it's a good thing that like these people are pretty and that like those people are rich, because otherwise like you wouldn't be able to solve any of your problems. but I think that's also why I wanted to like go and do more research and understand the context when it came out, because I was feeling very much that it's like
not a 2020 movie.
It's not a 2020 movie.
It ends like at the like giant mansion, like just like,
right,
you know,
Everybody's married. Everybody's rich.
She gets the most money, like at the end, also, right? In addition to the like true love.
But and again, and the very little bit of research I was able to do, it did help me understand that when this book came out, and of course, I'm sure you know this, Altricia, obviously, but like that the themes of individual happiness mattering whatsoever, especially for women, were radical. Like, yes. This was a radical book at the time. And so I think really like understanding that deeply made me appreciate all of it so much more. And so it still has a happy ending for the time where everyone gets the thing that they want and need for society. But in the meantime, it's dealing with kind of crazy radical ideas of like maybe individual happiness is interesting. And when is it right to put your happiness before familial obligation, and kind of raising interesting questions that are still relevant in many ways today.
Just to say this in words, the reason why like so many films that would be described as like women's movies or chick flicks, if we want to like throw that label on them, especially in the historical genre, but even now, the reason why so many of those films are about romantic plot lines and romantic themes are not because women are more interested in romance than men are. It is because for a long time in human history, that was the only arena in which they had any sort of life.
Mm-hmm.
They were not allowed to have any sort of business plot lines. They were not allowed to have any sort of like adventures. They were not allowed to have anything like that. The only kind of plot lines that women were allowed to have in history were plot lines, quote unquote, of romance. And that is why we see women at the center of romantic stories, particularly in historical contexts. And if that's a barrier for entry for you, it is because you probably haven't read enough history.
Right.
I don't know what else to say.
I mean, I agree. But then, you know, you also get some, you also get Lizzie Borden and Joan of Arc. So, you know, there's all sorts of plot lines.
Things went well for them. Everything went great for characters like that in history.
Right.
There's a great 30 Rock joke that's basically that also. And I feel like it's the frustration of like that lesson and that context. Like there is ignorance to that because it's also not like shown to people. Like I feel like at no point in my life did I encounter a situation where that information would have been like shown to me. And that's also why it's frustrating and has continued. And so I think I'm very happy that I've watched Pride and Prejudice now because it was a neat movie, but also because of this greater understanding that I feel like I have for this genre, I guess, but like movies of this time, stories of this time, understanding the cultural context, and that I think will help alleviate my barriers to entry. So instead of me just being like, oh, it's rich, pretty British people, like not having problems while the rest of the world is suffering, like understanding that within that there is intense human struggle and people maneuvering for equality and independence. Absolutely. Inside of that story.
Yeah, which brings me to a question I wanted to ask, because I was thinking about this. I was thinking about things that get adapted a lot and why they get adapted a lot.
Hmm.
And so something like Romeo and Juliet, it's like you can tell that story in one sentence and it feels visceral in the sense of two families hate each other, two of the kids fall in love. And because of the family's hate, it leads to their death. And it's like, oh, wow. Okay, that's like a strong, it's like, what a great love story. It's like, no, it's not. But it's
a great hate story.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the director, when I was in it, said this is actually a hate story, not a love story.
Yep.
But it's such an easy thing to wrap your head around. And then you have something like Pride and Prejudice, which has had multiple miniseries, multiple movies, Bridget Jones, obviously, Pride and Prejudice and zombies. Like it's been sort of, and I was reading like 200 different novels have been written by 50 different people that are sort of spin-offs that are set in the PNP universe, the PNPU, you
yes.
know, the PPU. So I was wondering, and this is a question for anybody, but mostly for Trisha's who's, you know, has studied this more, like, I think Pride and Prejudice is not such a simple plot to wrap your head around. It's, well, there's this character, they live in this world, the world has certain rules, they're supposed to marry, but they actually like that. And I'm wondering, like, for something that's not quite as cut and dry and simple, and something that was so ahead of its time for its time, but then now when you make it, you have to sort of explain the rules of this different time. Like, why do you think it is still to this day so adapted and so sort of has such staying power?
I think the main reason is because it really is a novel and a story of self-discovery and like self-work. Elizabeth and Darcy are only able to come together after they work on themselves and overcome their pride and prejudice. Like, that is the thing, is that they are having to question inside of themselves their own beliefs and their own value systems. It's a sign of maturity that when Elizabeth, you know, she forms very quick judgment, and so does Darcy, of who the other person is. Darcy happens to absolutely love her wit and her personality, but he is trapped by the value system of the world, the fact that she's in a different social standing, the fact that her family acts objectionably, you know, according to social mores and things like that. He has to examine in himself how important that is, and whether or not he's going to let it, you know, overcome his feelings, if he's going to make the quote unquote right or rational decision in the eyes of the world, or if he's going to make a difficult decision and face probably what are very real consequences from that.
Right.
And it's the same thing with Elizabeth. And I think that that is timeless. Humans are always journeying toward self-discovery and like self-actualization. We're sorting out our own priorities and value systems. Elizabeth has to realize how wrong she was. And that's always hard to admit. And I really love the proposal scene in the middle of this. It's a midpoint. I wanted to get Michael's take on it as a midpoint.
Midpoint.
But, hey. But I love that it brings out those very real issues. Those are not they are influenced, and their identities have been constructed by the social context in which they live. And we see the value system in the social context in which they live. But the conflict comes from what they personally are going through and what they personally believe. There's interior life and work that's being done. And that scene that comes to a head during Darcy's first proposal brings both of those things to the surface. It's not just, well, he told me I can't be with you, so I guess I can't.
Right.
You know, it's not that. It's like, I'm wrestling with this. And Elizabeth has to admit what she's wrestling with.
Right.
And that is timeless. And I do think that's a big part of the reason this continues to be adapted. The other reason, of course, is that anything that was revolutionary for women at the time sadly still feels revolutionary.
Sure.
Just to say that also in words.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, I had another just kind of more like fun question.
Yeah.
Which I raised before the podcast of just like, so my experience seeing this once again back, like it was, I think it was first year of college, and I still was in touch with my, like a lot of my girlfriends from high school. And this was like during Thanksgiving break, and we all went to go see it. And I was like stunned by like the overwhelming, like teenage girl reaction to Mr. Darcy. Like, like I just wouldn't have like, I would like watching like this character in this movie, like I wouldn't have thought this was like the pinnacle of like, take me, sir. Like this, like I want this man to take me.
Right.
So I just found it very fascinating. I'm like, why do we think that the character of Mr. Darcy is like such a thing?
I want to hear from everybody on this. Michael, what do you think?
Well, first of all, the midpoint I love because there's lots of rain, and anytime there's rain, it's working. So if you want to.
Sure I mean, it goes that. Back to that like messiness that makes them feel like real people, right? When they're drenched and
right,
you know,
like it's also down
still
and
it's gorgeous. It's still right. Like a gorgeous landscape and very romantic, but it's got that realism mixed in.
Rain just looks good on film.
It does.
I don't know that I can offer a super insightful answer. I feel like when she was like, oh, that's Mr. Darcy, and she gave him like eyes, I was like, wait, what? Like, that's Mr. Darcy? Like him? But I feel like that's often my reaction. I feel like I'm also fascinated by the different mechanics that go into attraction for people and how varied it can be, where like some people can almost universally be like celebrated as, you know, a symbol of attraction, and then other people are extremely polarizing. I just find that fascinating, and it's because I have no answers to explain it, and it's mostly puzzling. So I don't know, but by the end, I feel like I came around to Darcy mostly just because he's like a more interesting person. Like, I feel like in the same way that she's kind of like frustrated with societal life, he's kind of like strikes me as frustrated, but definitely in his own super rich, gonna collect sculptures from everywhere kind of a way.
So many sculptures.
Right. So like, yeah, if it's between him and the other guy, yeah, Darcy.
I'll get back to that in a minute. Go ahead, Brad. Tell us what you love about Darcy.
Look, I don't know, because I spent most of my 20s as the sulking guy in the corner of parties who kind of insulted people sometimes, and no one was infatuated with me. So I'm lost. Yeah.
Wrong era.
I think that a few things here with the Darcy archetype. I think that the thing that women are attracted to in the character, at least what I'm attracted to in the character, has to do with the fact that he... this, I don't know, it's probably corny to say, but like he sees Elizabeth and the ways that she upsets the value system. Yeah, doesn't adhere to her role in the way that she's necessarily supposed to. And Darcy is attracted to that in her, I think is like kind of the dream, right? Where it's like, if you could just have a guy that was like into the ways that you, I don't know, men tend to be threatened by women that don't stick in their roles. And so a man that is actually attracted to women, a woman who is not sticking in her social role, is like a huge turn on, because that is just so rare to find, rather than, you know, the typical response, which is what we see from Collins in this, right, where he's like, mm-hmm, I assume that you just wish to be shy and delicate, and right, you just wish to make seem more eager, not seem too eager. young ladies like it when I talk to them like this. We have all been courted by that guy, and there's nothing less attractive than a dude telling you what he thinks you are like.
Yeah.
When he doesn't know you. So I think it's that at its heart, probably, with the character of Darcy, sort of broadly speaking. I think the screenwriting here is really smart, because the ways that it differs from the book do humanize Darcy in some important ways. This is all present in the plot of the book, but the way that he talks to and talks with his sister is really important, where he's obviously really allowing her to grow into her own person. So we see that there's, it's not only Elizabeth that he like sees as this complete person, he also sees other women that way. So there's a consistency of character there that I think is really important. But also, yeah, he saves her family from financial ruin and social disgrace, and does so anonymously, right? Like there's some of these other things that the film date and the book take great care to establish within his character that they're just quote unquote traits that we all find virtuous or would like want to see from somebody. So even though he has some traits that are also difficult create, which actually honestly only create like sort of more mystery around him in a kind of appealing
right
way.
And but, I think in some way that's also maybe the male brain versus the female brain, like attraction mechanisms. Like I think there's something interesting that, because like it was me and a bunch of women, but we're all like attracted physically to men,
right?
But I was noticing there was like a different mechanism of attraction going on, where it's like my male brain was not putting together all the complexities that you just laid out. Whereas like, I feel like their brains were like doing a more complex algorithm of like, this equals yes, Mr. Darcy, right. Yes.
Well, and it probably has to do with all of the stuff that we've been talking about, which is that I wish this movie felt a little bit further removed from me than it does to you. it doesn't feel that far removed to me, actually, in terms of the value
system of the world. The algorithms that have to be done are still having to be done.
They're a lot fewer for me. It's not such a leap to imagine that the world would be like this for me. And, you know, even in your situation, Alex, there's a difference there in terms of like the pressures that are on the different characters.
Of course.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, no, that all the things you just laid out, like answer my question like 100%. It's really great answer. Thank you.
Yeah. You're very welcome.
I understand now the Mr. Darcy phenomenon.
I mean, although Matthew McFadden is a dreamboat, like he's a dreamy dreamboat, and they shot him like it when he's walking over the thing the in fog. The dawn.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The music there is so like epic.
I want to go in and add like a lightsaber turning on because I feel like he looks like a Jedi like emerging from the fog.
Seriously. Right.
His like cape billowing. Yeah.
Yeah. And shout out to the costume designer there, whose name I have written down somewhere. But she does a lot of the heavy lifting in Darcy's character to make him more and more approachable, right? Where he's so buttoned up. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's in Matthew McFadden's performance as well. And also, he's like 6'3 or 4 or something, which
seemed very tall.
Very tall. But he is so stiff and carries himself more aloofly at the beginning. And then there's this breaking down of it, down to that final scene where his whole costume is totally different. He's like in his pajamas, essentially, with a coat, you know. It's smart design in addition to smart writing.
Mm-hmm. Guys, I'm upset. I really want to rewatch Lord of the Rings, but ever since we set this Patreon goal where once we hit 500 patrons, we'll do 3 Lord of the Rings episodes and a Patreon exclusive episode on The Hobbit, I decided I should wait and hold off until we hit our goal. So I need your help, listener. We're about 3/4 of the way there, which means we're tiptoeing past the Black Gate and making our way to the secret stairs of Cirith Ungol. So it's up to you to help us fight off the big freaking spider, make our way through a sea of orcs, do a little dance with Gollum, and drop this thing in the fires of Mount Doom once and for all.
I knew what every term he just said meant.
I saw your face light up. It was so adorable.
I want to watch the movie now.
I'm speechless, and I'm with you. I want to watch these movies so badly. Please hurry up, Patreon.
Don't rewatch these movies, I really won't have any idea what any of that meant.
Why didn't the birds just fly them there?
They're eagles.
I can't wait to talk to you guys about that on this podcast.
Eagles are birds.
They do what they want.
Why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take away from Pride and Prejudice? Brian, do you want to start us off?
It's a weird one because you wouldn't think of it with this movie, but just tracking several characters over the course of a movie when almost none of them is a main character. So, you know, you have plenty of movies that are more like about an ensemble movie or something like that. But this movie is about basically four-ish people.
Mm-hmm.
But you have, 20 some people to keep track of over the course of it. And I personally have not written a lot with many, many characters. I've like the most I've written is like maybe like 5 in a scene. But in this movie, it's like there's rarely fewer than 4 people in a scene at any given time because there's 5 daughters and 2 parents. And then the, you know, Mr. Darcy and Bingsley. What's his name?
Bingley.
Thank you. And I just think it's cool to watch 2 different parts of it, one of which several characters in one scene where you are sort of tracking who's talking to whom and like what they're talking about and who cares about what and who's excited about this and who's upset about it and that kind of thing. But then also tracking them over the course of the movie. So the characters I think of are Jenna Maloney and Carey Mulligan's characters who are, or even Mary, like the goth daughter, you know, the one that I identify with.
Mary,
Where it's like, they have so little to do in the movie and you only see them maybe once every 20 some minutes, but every time you see them, you remember who they are and sort of what their relationship is and what they care about and all that kind of thing. So I just think it's a movie I'll come back to anytime I'm trying to, it's almost like I want to like make a spreadsheet, like who is in this scene, who says what, when did they say it, mm-hmm. what is their sort of interest in what's going on. And I just am fascinated anytime I see that many characters being handled just because it's not something that I've done very much.
Yeah. And actually your lesson is kind of related to mine, Brian, which is that I was talking about value systems earlier. I think it's important to note something this movie does really well, which is that just because you are trying as a screenwriter to establish a value system does not mean that every single person who lives according to the value system has the same personality.
Right. Definitely.
Which, so you have somebody like Caroline Bingley, who is, you know, very wealthy, has all of the status, has everything, has a completely different personality than someone like Mary Bennett. Right. Mm-hmm. You couldn't pick two more different women. And yet they're still bound within this value system where we see different opportunities for them to potentially break away from it or challenge it. And yet they don't, but for totally different reasons, because they are different people.
Yeah.
And so like the scene where Mary is playing the piano at the ball and then her dad comes and like shuts her down, and it's really moving and sad. Because the value system of the world is kind of crushing her, but for a different reason than it's restricting and hindering other people from pursuing their goals within the world. And so I love too the moment, every moment with Mary is like really beautiful, but also really sad.
Yeah.
Like the moment where Elizabeth turns down Collins, and then like she busts out the door and all of her sisters are standing out there, and the camera turns to Mary and kind of stays on her a minute longer. And you can see that like Collins is the person she's in love with, right? Like she and Collins would be a perfect match. And we see that and we know that and Mary knows that, but the rules of the world prevent that from ever happening. And as I pointed out earlier, Charlotte is another amazing example of that, where she is adhering to the value system and the rules of the world, but for completely different reasons because she's a different character. So when you're building out a value system, if you have every single character in your periphery saying the same thing, just like as a refrain of like, you have to marry well because that's what we do in the same way, that's not what it is to build a value system. A believable value system is still dynamic and still nuanced.
And it's not what it is to build a character.
And supporting characters are the way. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was impressive tracking all of that and how everyone, like you were saying, Brian, there were so many people and also they all live in the system, but all have very different relationships to it while still living within those boundaries. Pretty early on, I also Googled, because I was watching and I was like, okay, wait, who is that? And that's, so she's the sister of who now? And so I Googled.
Did you get a chart?
I immediately got a character genealogy chart. And I was like, you know what? No, this is too, I don't think this is going to help. I'm just going to watch the movie. And it was fine. But it was just funny because it was like, oh, wow, there's like a lot going on and this matters a lot.
Yeah.
People who can follow every single character who ever was in the background shot of an episode of Game of Thrones and who they are and what they want, and they claim they can't do it for like a period romance movie, I call BS.
For sure. No, that was immediately, because like, the only other thing I've seen that has genealogies is Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, this
you
is
can
not
do
as
it.
Complicated.
I believe in you, viewers.
But where are the dragons?
Fair point.
Alex, lesson.
It kind of goes off of what we said before about just how Joe Wright goes above and beyond with the way he shoots this film. And, you know, beyond the fact that he has these really wonderful long takes that actually do enhance the scenes. They're not just there to show off how they can pull off a one-er, but they're actually immersing you in a party or, you know, giving you kind of a snapshot of like 10 different characters across this party as we kind of pass by them. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of information being portrayed in these long takes, and the blocking is like amazing. I think there's a dance happening with the camera and the actors that is just so exquisitely blocked out. You just don't see that very often, where it just feels like the dance is just, it's all the beats are landing and it just feels effortless and lovely. So yeah, I think, once again, like we were saying, you could have shot this movie very conventionally, just a lot of shot, reverse shot dialogue scenes. But the fact that he chose to really immerse us in this world with, you know, a much more difficult approach, doing all the timing of all these little character moments happening right at the right time in the right place and having an uninterrupted camera move, like that's very difficult. And so I love them for embracing the difficulty of that to give us a more special film.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I think for me, it's the, again, going back to being really impressed by the witty dialogue and the way the characters express themselves. Yeah, appreciating how much of that came from the book also. I think it helped me appreciate this film because surface level plot stuff I wasn't necessarily deeply involved with. But underneath all of that, the characters' inner lives and what was being revealed about them was really interesting. And it's kind of a lesson I feel like we've talked about before, where what's happening on the surface doesn't always matter. It's what it's doing to the characters and how the characters are interacting that can draw people in and have an emotional effect. And I also kind of realized that it's like a forced subtext situation because of all the politeness and the manners and things, where it's like
so much subtext,
like no one can say directly what they want or what they think,
right?
And so there's just all these clever ways of like being as polite as possible to Dame Judi Dench while also saying not nice things to her at the same time,
right?
That I can't say on the podcast. So I was just struck by that, and I think it's a cool idea of creating constraints and kind of, you know, another opportunity. If you're building this value system, it's interesting that part of what comes with that value system are these boundaries where people can't say what they want or what they think. And so what other storytelling challenges and opportunities does that afford you as a storyteller?
And just really quickly, because we haven't talked about her, you could just cast Keira Knightley. I don't know. Right. She's so amazing in this film where half of the work that she does, she's not even speaking.
Yeah.
It's just sort of how she moves her head and her face. And the inner life that you're talking about is clearly so rich and just well understood and acted by her in this. And so her Oscar nomination for this is very deserved. She's wonderful in it.
Yeah. She's so good at being able to switch from cute and childish to just very graceful and poised at the same time, and as the same character in the same movie. And I think that's really impressive, because usually you cast someone because they're good at being one or the other. And then you have Rosamund Pike, who just makes me nervous now after Gone Girl. I'm like, don't marry her.
She's so sweet in this movie, though.
No, she's amazing. I love her. She's awesome.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah, whole cast. That was also funny, having not seen it then,
Carrie
and then going
Mulligan.
Back and everybody's in this.
Yeah.
Literally everyone. Great. Why don't we go around and say what we've been watching recently? Trisha, what have you been watching recently?
I will be as quick as I can. So I saw this movie, Emma, not E-M-M-A, the new version of Emma, which I've already talked about, but E-M-A, which is from 2019. It's a film by Pablo Larraín, is how I'm going to say the last name. He's a Chilean filmmaker, starring Mariana Di Girolamo and Gael Garcia Bernal. And
GGB.
The hottest man ever. It's a fantastic, and by that I mean literally fantastical kind of dance art movie, but it's also sort of this dark family drama about an adoption that's gone wrong. There's this couple and they're both heavily involved with this modern dance company, and they had adopted a troubled youth, and by the beginning of the movie they've returned him essentially into the foster care system because it didn't work out. But there's this whole backstory, but they're expressing a lot of it through dance. Gael Garcia Bernal's character is kind of the choreographer of the dance company. I thought of you so much when I was watching it, Alex. I was like, Alex would love this movie. It's gorgeous. All of the dance in it is gorgeous and wonderful. And it's just cool music. It's a very specific kind of music that I'm not going to attempt to describe, that is sort of uniquely born out of this culture and place. I was interested in it though, because the director, Pablo Larraín, is also the director of the upcoming Bad Robot Apple TV collaboration series on Lisi's Story, which is one of my favorite Stephen King books that I think I've mentioned before. So this same director is doing that adaptation of that book into an Apple TV series. I mean, knock wood, who knows now with anything that's in production. But essentially, but it's set to star Joan Allen, Clive Owen, and Julianne Moore. So
there you go.
It's Sounds probably going to be fine.
Yeah.
And I really love
Children of Men too.
Stephen King. Yeah. And Stephen King wrote all the episodes of the miniseries too. So just really, really excited about that. Emma from 2019, if you love psychedelic dance, dark dance movies.
Sounds good.
I like that these are specific niche corner, basically, right, with Trisha every time. It's great.
Yeah,
it's great.
Now she's going to go watch Dancer in the Dark with Bjork.
Awesome. Alex, what have you been watching?
I've been rewatching the Netflix German series Dark, which I can't stop talking about and bugging these guys about because I'm obsessed with it. I've been rewatching it because season three will be out by the time this podcast is out. It's the third and final season of the show. And from what I understand, it's basically all been mapped out since pretty early in the show's inception. So it's, you know, this one, it's a really cool experiment in, like, you know, knowing where your show ends from the beginning and just executing it. And so I'm really excited to see what they have in store for the ending. So anyway, yeah, if you are a fan of sci-fi, a fan of time travel stories, you gotta check out Dark. And I finally made Michael watch at least the first episode.
I watched the first two episodes last night and I was like, okay, yeah, that's pretty cool.
All right, good. I was telling Michael I was gonna have like kind of like a crisis if he like hated it or something, because I feel like it's like such an overlap of our interest. There's like crime drama involved, there's like really hard sci-fi, like all these overlapping things. And so if he hated that, he'd be like, wait, what are we, like, what's our collaboration anymore if you hate this?
It is really fascinating.
You guys don't need to go to therapy now.
Right, exactly.
It is really interesting. It also really feels like German Stranger Things.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Which is just really fun.
Yeah.
And to see that happening. Brian, what are you watching?
I've been rewatching Freaks and Geeks.
Nice.
Which I love so much and haven't rewatched in maybe close to 10 years at this point. I think it's my third time watching through it. And I love it so much. I think it's aged very well. It sort of commits to this realism with sort of actors who aren't always the best actors and stuff, and it makes for the sort of awkward feeling, but in this very real way that just makes me feel like I'm watching almost a documentary in this bizarre way, where it's just like it's like we are not doing the sort of actory thing here, we are doing the just whatever our kind of actor, like child actor reaction to this moment is and stuff. And I also just think the construction of each episode is really beautiful. Like, I was just struck by how every single episode feels like this complete story with like a heartbreaking crisis moment and just like these sort of themes that just really hurt to sort of watch these characters go through. And usually the Sam and Lindsay story, the sort of protagonist brother and sister, are tied together in some way where they're kind of both dealing with a similar take on a theme. And then it comes together a little bit, but it's usually not too much together. It's kind of they're on their own journeys and stuff. And yeah, I just think it's a really impressive show. And it's like, my girlfriend and I are kind of watching it slowly because we don't want it to be over. Like, yeah. I just feel like once it's over, we'll just start it again because it's just such a great thing to put on when we're like, maybe not a movie tonight, but like, let's just like chill and watch something that is very familiar and sort of feels like home to us in a weird way.
Totally.
So I recently watched a Netflix comedy special called Mike Birbiglia, the new one.
Yay! Oh, I love Mike Birbiglia. So oh good.
My girlfriend had seen his live show in LA and sort of just went to see it randomly and then came back and was like, it's amazing. I laughed, I cried, you have to watch it. And then when she saw it was on Netflix, and so finally it was like, I sat down and like, all right, let's give this a try, I'll do it. And I laughed and I cried, and it's just it's such a really, this kind of new sort of comedy special that I've been seeing more lately, where it's like it's half comedy stand-up jokes but half like really vulnerable, intense
storytelling,
revealing storytelling. And so it's the comedian Mike Birbiglia, and it's the show that he had on Broadway, and it's sort of like recounting this complicated emotional journey toward parenthood. And it's just, it goes to all the places and is delightful and heart-wrenching and all the things. So highly recommend. It was very good. Very glad that I watched it. So Mike Birbiglia, the new one.
It's a great thing to watch if you're in a dark place. It'll make you feel better for sure.
I kept wanting to say Mike Imbruglia.
Nope.
But that's different. And then that makes me want to sing the song.
Right. You were torn between which way to pronounce it.
No! Right.
Nothing's right. I'm torn. Great, everybody. This has been our conversation on Pride and Prejudice. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, as always, to the patrons for making this show possible. And we will see you in the next episode.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.